same years of the Islamic Spirit by Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 12, Tartars, the Scourge of God. The cause of Tartar invasion. Islam was confronted with another danger in the 7th century, unparalleled in the annals of the world, which was about to wipe it out of existence. This was the invasion of the wild and savage hordes of the Tartars, who issued forth from the Mongolian mountains and overpowered almost whole of the Islamic world with lightning speed. The immediate cause of the Mongol invasion can be attributed to a grievous mistake of Alauddin Muhammad, the Shah of Khwarizm. A body of traders who had arrived from Mongolia was put to death, and when Genghis Khan deputed an embassy to inquire into the reasons for it, Muhammad replied by killing the envoy too. On receiving the news of this outrage upon international courtesy, the Mongol king Genghis Khan deployed a whirlwind of savagery upon the world of Islam. However, if one were to look into the moral behavior and the attitudes of the ancient nations, particularly those relating to the Banu Israel, as well as their destruction and massacre, demolition and the sacrilege of Jerusalem, and the reasons therefore described in the Quran, one can clearly see, with the insight provided by the scriptures into the nature of historical processes, that the reason for converting the Islamic world into a vast carnal house was not a solitary act of cruelty on part of a reckless and haughty sovereign. As the Quran tells us, it was certainly not due to the mistake of a single individual that a storm of death and destruction burst forth on the entire world of Islam. If we were to cast a glance over the religious, moral, social, and political conditions of the Muslims in those days, there would be no difficulty in finding out the reason for this calamity. Such a survey would amply bear out that the carnage did not take place all of a sudden. It was a deeper, far-reaching reasons than those narrated by the historians. We shall have to look for these reasons into political situations and the social conditions of the Muslim society over a century or more prior to the Mongol invasion. After the death of Salahuddin in 589 AH, the vast empire carved out by him split into several independent principalities and kingdoms headed by his sons or successors. Like many other founders of the empires, his successors did not possess the talent of the original king, and what was more, they continued to fight each other for a very long time. Some of these did not hesitate to seek the assistance of the Christians against their own brothers, an instance of which has already been cited in the previous section. The whole of Islamic world was in fact in a state of chaos. Nowhere was to be found peace and tranquility. A moral and social disintegration was at work, which was clearly visible in the rapidly deteriorating political situation. The Crusaders were again making inroads into Muslim territories and had recaptured the lands emancipated from their clutches by Salahuddin. All those factors had already contributed to the repeated famines and epidemics. A fertile country like Egypt was so devastated by warfare between Al-Malik Al-Adil and his nephew that even the floods in Nile failed in 597 AH, that the country was overtaken by such a severe famine that the people had to resort to cannibalism. Death stalked over the lands, killing people in such large numbers that the dead had to be buried without shrouds. The annalist Abu Shama relates that Sultan Al-Malik Al-Adil provided shrouds for 220,000 dead bodies in a single month. People began to take the dogs and human flesh without any feeling of revulsion. Innumerable children were eaten away. Ibn Qasir writes that a stage came when children and youth of tender age were all eaten up, and people began to kill one another to satisfy their hunger. There were grim reminders of God calling people to a sincere penance for their sins and mending their ways. The ravages of famine and pestilence were followed by a severe and widespread earthquake, which hit the region covering Syria, Asia Minor, and Iraq. The destruction and devastation wrought by the earthquake can be judged from the fact that in the town of Nablus and its surrounding district, 20,000 people were crushed under foreign houses. Another historian writes that 1,100,000 people died as a result of this earthquake. On the one hand, these natural calamities were visiting the Islamic world with unwelcome regularity, and on the other, there were feuds and forays which continued unabated. In 601 OH, the two chiefs belonging to the same family, Qatada Husseini of Mecca and Salim Husseini of Medina, were locked up in a hotly contested battle. In 603 AH, the deadly feuds between the Ghurids of Afghanistan and the rulers of Khwarizm flared up, which encouraged the Muslims to waste their energy and power by shedding each other's blood. This was the state of affairs on one side, while the Christendom was infamed. Another crusade on the other, barely 2 years after the death of Salahuddin, and landed its forces on Syrian coast in 604 AH. The rulers of Al-Jazeera were secretly in league with the Tranks and the French in 607, while Demiti in Egypt, a city of considerable military importance, had fallen to the Crusaders in 616 AH. In the metropolis of Islam, Baghdad, the magnificence and the splendor of the Caliph's court, copied from the etiquettes observed by the Iranians and the Byzantine empires, had touched the summit of extravagance. It is difficult to imagine the wealth amassed by such personal servants of the Caliph as cupbearers and menders of wardrobes, who normally entered the service merely as slaves. The annual income from the property acquired by Alauddin At-Tabrasi Al-Zahri, a slave purchased by Caliph Al-Zahir, is reported to have been as much as 300,000 dinars. The house built by him in Baghdad was conspicuous for its size and beauty. Similar was the case with other state officials. The former had an annual income of 500,000 dinars, while the latter, as mentioned in the names, although an illiterate man, lived like a prince. The analysts have left staggering accounts of their lavish expenditures on marriages of their sons and daughters. On the other hand, the teachers of the celebrated madrasa were doled out such paltry sums, which bore no comparison to the wages paid to the meanest of the state employees. The most erudite scholars and professors did not get more than 12 dinars a month, while the servant of Al-Sharabi, a grandee of the Abbasid regime, could spend 400,000 dinars on a marriage and pay another 3,000 as a price for a bird brought from him from Mosul. The royal processions of the Caliph on the occasion of Eid and to mark the anniversary of their succession to the throne was seized as an opportunity for the display of royal pomp by the Khalifa. The whole of Baghdad came out to witness these processions in a mood free and easy, amusing and entertaining itself, and oblivious to even obligatory prayers. In 640 AH, the royal procession, taken out on the occasion of Eid, terminated on after the nightfall, with the result that most of the people witnessing the processions performed Eid prayers just before midnight. Again, in 644 AH, a large number of people missed the prayers on the occasion of Eid and performed the same at the time of sunset. The usual mode of making obeisance to the Khalifa was to bow almost to the ground, touch the ground with one's nose, but nobody even felt it anything opposed to the teachings of the Sharia or degrading of his independent and manly character. Confiscation of private property had become a common affair. Illegal gratification by officials was widely prevalent. Immodesty and grossness of conduct was on the rise. The Bathanites and the swindlers were basking in sunshine. Everyone seemed to be after wealth. Love of music had grown almost into a craze. In short, the common pursuits of the people and the social and moral disintegration of the society threw a lurid light on the state of chaos then prevailing in the Islamic world. This was the time when the Mongols were devastating Turkestan and Iran and were casting a glance over Baghdad. The year 626 AH began, writes Ibn Kathir, with the indecisive yet long battles between the monarchs of the House of Ayyubids. Such a state of chaos prevailed in Baghdad, the center of the caliphate, that 640 to 643 AH, no arrangements could be made by the Khalifa for sending out Hajj parties, nor was the covering of the Kaaba sent by the Khalifa. For 21 days, the walls of the holy shrine remained without a cover, which was taken as an ill omen by the people. Ahmad Abul Abbas succeeded his father under the mantle al-Nasir al-Din-Ilahi. He had an opportunity to rule for 46 years. His reign was the longest one ever enjoyed by any Abbasid Khalifa, yet perhaps it was one of the darkest times of all regimes in the house of the Abbasids. Historians were severely critical of his regime for tyranny and maladministration. Writes Ibn Kathir, he was a tyrant who ill-treated the people. Iraq was devastated during the regime, its population migrated to neighboring countries, and their possessions were confiscated by the Khalifa. He gave contradictory orders, rescinded the orders given by him a day earlier. Being too much interested in politics and pastime, he had prescribed a special uniform which could be put on only by those permitted to take part in gymnastics and athletic sports. His orders so severely curtailed the sports that these activities practically came to an end in Iraq. His interest in entertainment had grown almost into a craze. The Iranians accused him of inviting the Mongols to attack the Muslim territories and hatching a conspiracy for the same. Al-Nasir ad-Din Ilahi died 622 AH and Mustansir Billahi ascended the throne. He was a just, mild, benevolent, and a pious ruler, recalling the rightly guided caliphs, but unfortunately he did not get enough time to reform the administration. He was succeeded by his son, Mu'tasim Billah, in 640 AH. He too was a pious and a just sovereign who never touched wine or indulged in immodest acts. He committed the Quran to memory and observed fast on Mondays and Thursdays, in addition to the fasts on the months of Ramadan and Rajab. He is reported to be punctual in the performance of prayers, but according to Ibn Kathir, he too was mild and miserly and lacked foresight. In 642 AH, a man by the name Muawid ud-Din Muhammad ibn Al-Qami was appointed as prime minister by Khalif Musta'sim. Disorder and disturbance were the source of constant trouble in Baghdad, especially when the Sunnis and the Shias were fighting in 655 AH. It is reported that these riots, the Shia quarters, including those of the relatives of Ibn al-Qami, were plundered, which led to seek revenge from the Sunnis. Although the danger of the Mongol invasion was hovering over Baghdad, a great reduction was made in the armed forces on the advice of Ibn al-Qami. The number of cavalry was reduced to a mere 10,000. Their allowances and promotions were withheld. The disbanded soldiers were directed to take to trade and husbandry, with the result that many of them were later on begging alms in the bazaars and in the front of the mosques. Islam was reduced to a state of imbecility, which led many poets to compose eulogies to lament the helplessness of the Muslim people. Al-Musta'sim was personally a man of impeccable character. He also wanted to reform administration and bring peace and prosperity in his administration, but unfortunately, he lacked the courage, zeal, and the ability of the founders of the empire, which alone could have saved the situation by infusing a breath of new life into the tottering society and administration. It has happened more than once that the last monarch of any ruling dynasty was just and wise, virtuous and humane, but the degeneration of social and political order had reached a point in his time where its only natural outcome was a final decay and a crumbling down of that dynasty. This was the case with Mustahsim II, whom Providence had chosen for the badge of infamy, although he was better than most of his predecessors and also had a desire to set right the fastly deteriorating situation. It is undoubtedly true that a group of people, pure in spirit and righteous in conduct, were there teaching and preaching in the mosques and seminaries of Baghdad, but the affluent and those in authority had become so corrupt that an analyst of the age had described the situation prevailing in his time in the following words. The desire to acquire estate and effects has become a craze with the people who never think of community welfare. They are so engrossed in feathering their own nests that it is never to be deemed as a rightful course. The officials of the government are all tyrants who are obsessed with the idea of amassing as much wealth as possible. This is the most dangerous state of affairs, for the government can coexist with apostasy but never with tyranny. In the eastern part of the Islamic world, the kingdom of Khwarizm, raised towards the end of the 5th century of the Muslim era on the ruins of the Seljukid Empire, held sway over almost the entire Islamic territories, excluding the principalities of Seljukid sultans over the parts of Egypt, Syria, and Iraq, Hejaz, Asia Minor, and that of the Ghurids in Afghanistan. Sultan Ala'uddin Muhammad Khwarizm Shah was one of the most powerful Muslim monarchs, or perhaps the most powerful or the greatest sovereign of his day. Harold Lam writes in his famous book Genghis Khan in the following words. In the center of Islam, Muhammad Shah of Khwarizm was enthroned himself as a warlord. His domain extended from India to Baghdad and from the Sea of Aral to the Persian Gulf. Except for the Seljukid Turks, victors over the Crusaders and the rising Mamluk dynasty in Egypt, his authority was supreme. He was the emperor and the caliph, and who quarreled with him but might not deny him was restricted to the spiritual authority of a pope. Muslim historians have not mentioned any noticeable personal laxity in the character or moral behavior of Khwarizm Shah. On the other hand, they speak of him as a brave and chivalrous ruler, just and pious, but there was no denying the fact that he spent his prowess and capabilities in subjugating the Muslim kingdoms around his dominion. In the northwest of his territory, he forced the Seljukids to retreat to the furthest end, which he restrained the westward ambitions of the Ghurids by subjugating Khorasan, Kirman, Ghazni, and Transnoxia. Those unending wars of Khwarizm Shah had nevertheless worn out his troops, who had strained every nerve in achieving the conquest they had hoped for. Apart from the war phobia normally created by the continuous warfare over a long period of time, the conquest of the most fertile and industrially developed areas had brought to the capital of Khwarizm Shah all the toil and labor could produce, along with attendant vices of opulence and luxury. It was difficult to find any detailed account of these social ills in the annals of the time, which are mostly concerned with the description of kings and emperors. Unfortunately, however, the treatise and the sermons, monographs, and discourses of the saints and the preachers, which would have thrown a lurid light on the subject, were also destroyed by the Mongolian avalanche. There is hardly any reason for attributing the following statement of Harold Lam to his religious prejudice or exaggeration. He writes, it was a martial world, appreciative of song, with an ear not unmusical, a world best by inward thrones, slave-ridden wealth gathering, and more than a little addicted to vice and intrigue. It left the management of its affairs to extortioners and its women to the custody of eunuchs and its conscience to the keeping of God. The Sultan of Khwarizm made the same fatal mistake which was committed by the Moors in Spain, an unpardonable blunder under divine law of retribution governing the historical process. They set about, body and soul, to extend and strengthen to strengthen their empire at that point of time. Lamb agrees to the following accounts by Muslim historians in his following words. But the Mongol experiment with trade came to an abrupt end. A caravan of several hundred merchants from Karakom was seized by one Inaljuk, governor of Otrar, a frontier citadel belonging to Shah. Inaljuk reported to his master that spies were among the merchants, which may well have been the case. Muhammad Shah, without considering the matter overmuch, sent for his governor and ordered to slay the merchants, and all of them accordingly were put to death. This in due time was reported to Genghis Khan, who dispatched envoys at once to Shah to protest, and the Muhammad found it to be appropriate to slay the chief of the envoys and burn off the beards of the others. When the survivors of the embassy returned to Genghis Khan, the master of Gobi went apart to a mountain to meditate upon the matter. The slaying of a Mongol envoy could not be unpunished. Tradition required revenge for the wrong inflicted. There cannot be two suns in the heavens, the Khan said, and the two Khans upon the earth. The Tartar invasion. Thus the storm burst in 616 AH. Bukhara was forced to raise to the ground and its inhabitants were put to the sword. Samarkand was reduced to ashes and its entire population was killed. Other important and populous cities like Ray, Hamadan, Meri, Nishapur met the same fate. The forces of Khwarizm Shah, the most popular Muslim and the most powerful Muslim sovereign of his day, were simply swept away by the Mongol arms. Khwarizm Shah was himself hunted from place to place by the Tartars with ruthless tenacity. Muhammad Khwarizm Shah ultimately took refuge in an unknown island in the Caspian Sea, where he died broken-hearted, alone and abandoned. Khwarizm Shah had already dismembered the independent Islamic kingdom of Iran and Turkmenistan, and therefore none had remained in the east to check the onslaught of the Mongols after his defeat. The Muslims were so seized by the terror of the Mongols that often a lonely Mongol attacked 100 of them, but none of them had the heart to defend himself. Every one of them was killed by the Tartar without being opposed by a single Muslim. Even a Mongol woman dressed as a man plundered a house and killed all of its inmates, excepting a captive. It was only after this that the captive somehow came to know that this was a woman and he could muster enough courage to kill her. It often happened that the Mongol caught hold of a Muslim, asked him to wait there till he brought a machete to slaughter him, and this poor man did not have the courage to run away in the absence of the Mongol. The scourge of God was the greatest calamity before which almost the entire world of Islam was swept away as by a torrent. It left the Muslims astounded and terror-stricken. The Mongols came to be regarded so invincible that an Arabic proverb gained currency, which meant that if anybody tells you that the Tartars have suffered a defeat, then don't believe him. Death and destruction was a foregone conclusion for all the lands through which the Tartars passed. Palaces, mosques, museums were all leveled to the ground and trampled into dust. Historians were are normally prone to be objective in their assessment of the past events, but even such a cool and tempered historians as Ibn al-Kathir could not help shedding his tear over the havoc and ruin caused by the scourge and the savage ardor of the Mongols for their rape and slaughter. Speaking of these events in a harrowing strain, Ibn al-Kathir writes, "These events are so frightful and heart-rending that for several years I was in a fix whether I should narrate these happenings or not. I have, however, penned these facts most reluctantly in truth and reality. It is not easy to recount the tale of carnage and atrocities perpetrated on the Muslims, nor can one bear with equanimity the abasement to which the Muslims were subjected. I only wish that my mother had not given me birth. Oh, would I have died before I had to relate this toll of destruction? Some of my friends had insisted that I should record these events, but I was still irresolute. Later, it dawned on me that it was of no profit to forego the task. The invasion of the Tartars was one of the greatest calamities and the most terrible devastation on which there is no parallel in the annals of the world. This calamity fell on all Muslims and all nations, but the Muslims had to endure this more than anybody else. If one were to claim that the world, since God created it to its present times, was never so afflicted, one would be speaking the truth, for history records no other event which approaches it, or perhaps the world may not see its like again except for the calamity of Gog and Magog till the dawn of the doomsday. The Tartars put to the sword all men, women, and children, cut open the bellies of pregnant women, and trampled the babies to death. Verily, unto God we belong, and to Him we shall return. There is no power and no might but from God, the Most High, the Most Great." This was an affliction which overwhelmed the entire world like a severe torrent. It suddenly swept over all the lands. The author of Mirsad ul Abad, who belonged to Hamdan and was born at Ray and was thus an eyewitness to the Mongol invasion, has left the following harrowing account. "In year 617 AH shall ever remain conspicuous in the annals of the world for the hordes of the Tartars who gained ascendancy over the Muslims in that year. The way they ravaged the countries, killed the people, plundered and burned the cities has a parallel neither in the days of ignorance nor thereafter. It is enough to mention that in Ray, where I was born, and I lived in Turkestan and in the lands extending from Rome to Syria, more than 700,000 people were put to the sword or made captives. The calamity befalling Islam and its adherents is beyond description, and the Holocaust is rather too well known to require any detailed description. God forbid none of the monarchs and sovereigns of Islam felt the urge to defend the honor of Islam, nor were they alive to their duty to coming to the rescue of their subjects. Although they were like shepherds unto their own people, they would render an account in regards to their safety on the day of judgment. It was their duty to have strained every nerve to strengthen Islam and defend the faith as God had ordered. Go forth light-armed or heavy-armed and strive with your wealth and your lives in the way of God as mentioned in the Quran. They should have sacrificed everything they had, their lives, their riches, for the honor of Islam. This would have given heart to others and fired a frenzy of enthusiasm amongst the Muslims, who would have contained and turned back the onslaught of these savages. But now nothing remains except to seek refuge in God. Whatever of Islam is still visible is exposed to danger of being completely removed from the face of this earth, leaving no trace of it whatsoever." Not the Muslims alone, but the entire civilized world trembled before the savage Tartars. Their atrocities had caused a flutter even in those far-off corners of the world where the Tartars could have hardly been expected to carry their arms. historians write in the history decline and the fall of the Roman Empire in the following words: the Latin world was darkened by this cloud of savage hostility. A Russian fugitive carried the alarm to Sweden and the remote nations of the Baltics, and the oceans trembled at the approach of the Tartars, whom their fear and ignorance were inclined to separate from the human species. The maddening frenzy for death and destruction aroused by Genghis Khan amongst the Mongols and the significance of his upsurge has been well summoned by the authors of the Cambridge Medieval History in the following words: unchecked by human values, they were able to overcome the terrors of vast deserts, the barriers of mountains and the seas, the severities of the climates, and the ravages of famine. No danger could appall them, no stronghold could resist them, no prayer for mercy could move them. We are confronted with a new power in history, with a force that was to bring to an abrupt end an entire empire, many dramas that would otherwise have ended in a deadlock or would have dragged on for many, many years. Harold Lamb continues in The Impact of Genghis Khan in the following words: this new power in Baghdad, the ability of one man to alter human civilization, began with Genghis Khan and ended with his grandson Kublai, when Mongol Empire tended to break up. It has not reappeared since then. The sack of Baghdad. At the last in 656 AH, the myriads of savages advanced towards Baghdad, killing every man that came in their way, setting fire to every house, and trampling into dust whatever they could not possess. The metropolis of Islam, celebrated throughout the world as a center of civilization, learning, and crafts, was reduced to ashes. The sack of Baghdad is too harrowing and lengthy to be detailed here. The accounts given by historians include some eyewitness accounts of the carnage and atrocities committed by the Mongols. Ibn al-Kasir writes, the horrors of rape and slaughter lasted 40 days, and after the carnage was over, the most populous and the most beautiful city in the world was so devastated that only a few people could be seen there. All the streets and the markets were strewn with dead bodies. Heaps of corpses were to be found like small mounds from place to place. After the rain, the dead bodies begin to rot, giving out a discernible smell of the flesh, and then a deadly disease ravaged the towns, which spread as far as the lands of Syria. Innumerable people died as a result of this epidemic, the ravages of a terrible famine, and the disease and the rising prices reigned over the city thereafter. Tajuddin ibn Sabki gives his own account of the barbaric acts of the Mongols in the following words: Halaku received the caliph in a tent where Ibn al-Alqami invited the doctors of religion and other notables of the city to be witness to the agreement between Halaku and the caliph. When they had repaired to the Mongol camp, all were passed under the sword. They were called one by one in a tent and beheaded until none of them amongst the chiefs and the counselors of the caliph remained alive. It was commonly believed that if the blood of the caliph fell on the ground, some calamity would overtake the world. Halaku was therefore hesitant, but Nasiruddin Tusi intervened to suggest that the problem could be easily solved. The caliph should be killed, he suggested, in a way that his blood did not fall on the ground. The caliph was accordingly rolled in a carpet and beaten to death. The general massacre continued in Baghdad for more than 1 month. Only those who could save themselves who were able to find a hiding place. Halaku then ordered it to be related to count the dead, who numbered 1,800,000. Christians were asked to take bacon and wine publicly. Although it was the month of Ramadan, the Muslims of Baghdad were compelled to participate in drinking bouts. Wine was sprinkled in the mosques and the call for prayer was prohibited. Nothing so despicable had happened since the foundation of Baghdad, where laid. The city had come under the heathen rule for the first time and had never before undergone such a humiliation. In spite of all its vices and weakness, Baghdad was the metropolis of Islam, the center of learning, arts and crafts, as well as a city of mosques and shrines. Its destruction made the heart of every Muslim bleed. The heart-rending account of its ruin was rendered by many poets into songs of mourning. Sa'di al-Shiraz, who had lived in Baghdad during his student days and had seen the city in its heyday of glory, has described the fall of Baghdad in a language that shows his death and depth of misery. For it has been seen in the kingdom of Mu'tasim destroyed, the heavens could be justified if it sheds rain tears of blood. If you rise on the day of judgment, O Muhammad, rise now to see the most severe affliction. The blood of the beauties slaughtered in the castle overflows the gates of the palace, and our tears stain our garments. Be aware of the turns of time and its vicissitudes, for who knew the glorious would come to such an abrupt end? Lo, you had seen the glory of the house of Caliphs, where the Caesars, Kakans, bowed low in obeisance. The blood of the progeny of Muhammad's uncle is shed on the very earth where the Sultan placed their heads. Colored with blood, the waters of the Tigris will turn the ground red. If it flows to irrigate the desert oasis of Ba'ta, defaced by the calamity it has had to suffer, wrinkles of waves were seen on the waves of the Tigris. No eulogy is really befitting the elevated souls whose minimum reward is the bliss of God in paradise. I'm shedding my tears only in sympathy, for Muslims they were, and I hold them dear. From Baghdad, the Mongols marched towards Halep, which is Aleppo, and sacked the city and turned to Damascus. They captured Damascus in 658 AH. The Christian inhabitants of the city came out with presents to greet the conquerors. Ibn Kathir, who belongs to Damascus, has portrayed the joy of the Christians and the helplessness of the Muslims in these words. The Christians came back by the gate of Toma, carrying the cross over their heads and shouting slogans. They were praising Christianity and openly disparaging Islam and the Muslims. They had flasks of wines from which they sprinkled the liquor in front of the mosques and on the faces of the Muslims they happened to pass by. Ordering the Muslims to pay homage to their emblem, Muslims could not restrain themselves for long and gathered in large numbers and pushed them back to the Cathedral of Mary, where Christian clergy delivered a speech praising Christianity and denigrating Islam and its followers. Thereafter, Ibn Kathir continues his description on the authority of Zayl al-Murta. The Christians then entered the mosque with wine in their hands. They intended to pull down the number of mosques in the case of the reign of the Tartars continued for some time more. Ulama, Qazis, and other Muslim notables repaired to the citadel of the Tartar governor to make a complaint about the excesses of the Christians, but they were turned out by him. El-Siran, the governor, however, gave a hearing to the Christians. Verily, unto God we belong, and to God we shall return. After the fall of Syria, the Mongols wanted to carry their arms to Egypt. It was the only Muslim country still out of their reach. The Sultan of Egypt, Al-Malik Al-Muzaffar Saifuddin Qataz, knew that his country would be the next target of the Mongols, and also that it could be difficult to hold off these savages if they were allowed to make adequate preparations for invading his lands. He therefore decided to attack the Mongols in Syria before they were able to consolidate their power. The forces of Egypt accordingly met the Mongols at Ain Jalut, a town near Nazareth in Palestine, on the 25th of Ramadan under the command of Babers, who afterwards became the sovereign of Egypt. Unlike previous battles, the Muslims met Mongol in a hotly contested battle and drove back the stream of savages. The Egyptians persuaded the defeated Mongols slaughtering and capturing a large number of them eastward beyond the Euphrates. The Muslims were, by the grace of God, victorious, and they were inflicted a grave defeat on the Tartars. A large number of Tartars were put to the sword. The retreating Tartars were so disheartened that the people easily caught hold of them and took their belongings. Sultan Baber defeated the Tartars in many a fierce battles after the Battle of Ain Jalut, and thus disproved the proverb that the Tartars were invincible. The conversion of the Tartars to Islam. Islam was about to be submerged in a whirlpool of Mongol ardor, of slaughter and destruction, as several Muslim writers had then expressed the fear wiping Islam out of existence. But Islam suddenly began to capture the hearts of the savage Tartars. The preachers of Islam thus accomplished a task which the sword had failed to perform, by carrying the message of Islam to the barbaric Tartars. Conversion of the Mongols to Islam was indeed one of the few unpredictable events of history. The Tartar wave of conquest, which had swept away the entire Islamic East within a short period of 1 year, was in truth not so astounding as the Mongol acceptance of Islam during the zenith of their glory, for the Muslims had, by the beginning of the 7th century of the Islamic era, imbibed all those vices which are natural outcome of opulence, luxury, and fast living. The Mongols were, on the other hand, wild and ferocious people, yet a vigorous and sturdy race who could have hardly been expected to submit to the spiritual and cultural superiority of a people so completely subdued by them, and who were also looked down and despised by them. The author of Preaching of Islam, T.W. Arnold, has also expressed his amazement over the achievement of this unbelievable feat. He writes, "But Islam was to rise again from the ashes of its former grandeur, and through its preachers win over these savagest conquerors to the acceptance of their faith. This was a task for the missionary energies of Islam that was rendered more difficult from the fact that there were two powerful competitors in the field. The spectacle of Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam striving to win the allegiance of the fierce conquerors had set their feet on the necks of the adherents of these great missionary religions is one that is without parallels in the history of the world. For Islam to enter into competition with such great powerful rivals as Buddhism and Christianity was at the outset of the period of the Mongol rule must have appeared a hopeless undertaking, for the Muslims had suffered more from the storms of the Mongol invasion than the others. Those cities that had hitherto been the rallying point of spiritual organization and learning for Islam in Asia had been for the most part laid into ashes. The theologians and the pious doctors of faith were slain or carried away into captivity. Among the Mongol rulers, usually so tolerant towards all religions, were some who exhibited varying degrees of hatred towards the Muslim faith. Genghis Khan had ordered that all those who killed animals in the Muslim fashion were to be put to death, and this ordinance was revived by Qubayli, who by offering rewards to informers set on foot a sharp persecution that lasted for 7 years. As many poor people took advantage of this ready means of gaining wealth and slaves and accused their masters in order to gain their freedom. During the reign of Quyuk, who left the conduct of affairs completely to his two Christian ministers and whose court was filled with Christian monks, the Muslims were made to suffer great severities. Arghun, the fourth king, persecuted the Muslims and took away from them all the posts in the Department of Justice and Finance and forbade them to appear in court. In spite of all these difficulties, however, the Mongols and the savage tribes that followed in their wake were at length brought to submit to the faith of those Muslim people whom they had crushed beneath their feet. Unbelievable and of far-reaching significance, although the conversion of the Mongols to Islam had been, it was not less surprising that extremely few and scanty records of this glorious achievement are to be found in the annals of the time. The names of only a few dedicated saviors of Islam who won proselytes from the savage hordes are known to the world, but their ventures was no less daring or their achievement less significant than the accomplishment of the warriors of the faith. Their memory shall be enriched by the gratitude of Muslims, for they had in reality performed a great service for humanity in general and to the Muslims in particular by diffusing the knowledge of faith among the barbarians, winning them over the service of God and making them the standard bearers of the Apostle of God and the Apostle of Peace. After the death of Genghis Khan, the great heritage of the Mongol conqueror and the empire was divided into four dominions headed by the offsprings of his sons. The message of Islam had begun to spread amongst all four sections of the Mongols, who were rapidly converting to the faith. In regard to the conversion of the ruling princes in the lineage of Batu, the son of Genghis Khan's firstborn Juji, who ruled the western portion as Khan of the Golden Horde, writes Arnold in his following words: "The first Mongol ruling prince who professed Islam was Baraka Khan, who was the chief of Golden Horde from 1256 to 1267. According to Abul Ghazi, who was converted after he had come to the throne, he is said one day to have fallen in a caravan coming from Bukhara and taking two of the merchants aside to have questioned them on the doctrines of Islam, and they expounded to him their faith so persuasively that he became converted in all sincerity. He first revealed his change of faith to his youngest brother, whom he induced to follow his example, and then made an open profession of his new belief. Baraka Khan entered into a close alliance with Mamluk Sultan of Egypt. The initiative came from the latter, who had given a hospitable reception to the body of troops, 200 in number, belonging to the Golden Horde. These men, observing the growing enmity between the Khan and Hulaga, the conqueror of Baghdad, in whose army they were serving, took flight into Syria, when they were honorably conducted to Cairo, to the courtyard of the Babers, who persuaded them to embrace Islam. Babers himself was at war with Hulagu, whom he had recently defeated and driven out of Syria. He sent two of the Mongol fugitives with some other envoys to bear a letter to Baraka Khan. On their return, these envoys reported that each prince and amir at the court of Baraka Khan had an imam and a muadhin, and the children were taught the Quran in the schools. These friendly relations between the Babers and Baraka Khan brought many of the Mongols of the Golden Horde into Egypt, where they became Muslims. Halaku had founded the dynasty of Ikhans in Iran, to which he had later added a great part of Asia Minor. Arnold relates the conversion of this branch of Genghis Khan's progeny in the following words: "In Persia, where Halaku founded the dynasty of the Ikhans, the progress of Islam amongst the Mongols was much slower. In order to strengthen himself against the attacks of Baraka Khan and the Sultan of Egypt, Hulagu accepted the alliance of the Christian powers of the East, such as the King of Armenia and the Crusaders. His favorite wife was a Christian and was favorably disposed the mind of her husband towards her co-religionists, and his son Abaka Khan married the daughter of the Emperor of Constantinople. His brother Takudar, who succeeded him, was the first of the Ikhans to embrace Islam. He was brought up as a Christian. He was baptized when he was young and called the name Nicholas. But when he had grown up, through his intercourse with Saracen, of whom He was very fond. He became a base Sarakan and renounced the Christian faith and wished to be called Muhammad Khan, and strove with all his might that the Tartars should be converted to the faith and the sect of Muhammad. And when they proved obstinate, not daring to force them, he brought about the conversion by giving them honors and favors and gifts, so that in time many Tartars were converted to the faith of the Muslims. This prince sent the news of his conversion to the Sultan of Egypt in the following letter: "By the power of God Almighty, the mandate of Ahmad of the Sultan of Egypt, God Almighty, praised be his name, by his grace preventing us, and by the light of his guidance, has guided us in our early youth and vigor in the true path of knowledge of his deity and the confession of his unity, to bear witness that Muhammad is the prophet of God, and his reverence his saints and his pious servants, whom God shall please to guide, that men's breast will be open to Islam. We ceased not to incline our hearts to the promotion of the faith and the improvement of the condition of the Muslims and Islam, but to the times when the succession of the empire came to us from our fathers and our brothers, and God spread over us the glory of his grace and kindness, so that in the abundance of his favors our hopes were realized, and God revealed to us the bride of the kingdom, and she was brought forth to us as a noble spouse. General assembly was convened, wherein our brothers, our sons, our great nobles, generals of the army and captains of the forces met to hold council, and they all agreed on carrying out the order of our elder brother, which is to summon here a vast levy of our troops, whose numbers would make the earth, despite its vastness, appear too narrow, whose fury and fierce onset would fill the heart of men with fear, being animated with the courage before which the mountains peak bow down, and a firm purpose that makes the hardest rock go soft. We reflected on this resolution, which expressed the wish of all, and we concluded that it ran counter to the aim that we had in view, to promote the common weal and to strengthen the ordinance of Islam. Never, as far as lies in our power, to issue any order that will not tend to prevent bloodshed, remove the ills of men, and cause the breeze of peace and prosperity to blow over all lands, and kings of other countries to rest upon the couch of affection and benevolence, whereby the commands of God will be honored, and mercy will be shown to the people of God. Herein God inspired us to quench this fire, and put an end to all these terrible calamities, and make known to those who advanced his proposal of a levy, that it is God that has put in our hearts to do, namely, to employ all possible means for the hearing of all sickness in the world, and putting off what should only be appealed as a last remedy. For we desire not to hasten to appeal to arms until we have first declared the right path, and will permit it only after setting forth the truth and establishing it with proofs. Our resolve is to carry out whatever appears to us good and advantageous, has been strengthened by the counsel of Sheikh al-Islam, the model of divines, who has given us much assistance in religious matters. We have appointed our Chief Justice Qutbuddin and Atabak Bahauddin, both trustworthy people of this flourishing kingdom, to make known to you our course of action, and bear witness to our good intentions for the common welfare of the Muslims, and to make it known that God has enlightened us, and that Islam annuls all that has gone before it, and that God Almighty has put it in our hearts to follow the truth and those who practice it. If some convincing proof be required, let men observe our actions. By the grace of God, we have raised the standards of faith and borne witness to it in all our orders and our practices, so that the ordinance of the law of Muhammad might be brought to the fore, and be firmly established in accordance with the principles of the justice laid down by Ahmad, whereby we have filled the hearts of the people with joy and have granted free pardon to all offenders and shown them indulgence by saying, may God pardon the past. We have reformed all the matters concerning the pious endowments of the Muslims given for the mosques, colleges, charitable institutions, and the rebuilding of carnivores. We have restored their incomes to those to whom that they are due according to the terms laid down by the donors. We have ordered all the pilgrims to be treated with respect, provisions to be made for their caravans and for securing their safety on the pilgrim routes. We have given perfect freedom to merchants traveling from one country to another, where they may go as they please. And we have strictly prohibited our soldiers and police from interfering with them in their comings and their goings. He seeks the alliance of the Sultan of Egypt so that these countries and cities may again be populated. These terrible calamities to be put down, the sword to be returned to the scabbard, and all the people may dwell in peace and quietness, and the necks of the Muslims be freed from the ills of humiliation and disgrace. To the students of history of the Mongols, it is a relief to pass from the recital of nameless horrors and bloodshed to a document emanating from the Mongol prince and giving expression to such humane sentiment, which sounds strange indeed coming from such lips. A revolt broke out against him, headed by his nephew, who compassed his death and succeeded him to the throne. During his brief reign, the Christians were once more restored to favor, while the Muslims had to suffer in their turn, were dismissed from their posts and driven away from the court. The successor of Takudar were all heathen until in 1295, Ghazan, the seventh and the greatest of the Ikhlans, became a Muslim and made Islam the ruling religion of Persia. Ghazan himself, before his conversion, had been brought up as a Buddhist and had erected several Buddhist temples and took great pleasure in the company of the priests of his faith who had come into Persia in large numbers since the establishment of Mongol supremacy over that country. He appears to have been naturally religious turn of mind, for he studied the creeds of different religions of his time and used to hold discussions with the learned doctors of each faith. Rashid al-Din, his learned minister and the historian of his reign, maintained the genuineness of his conversion to Islam, the religious observance of which he zealously kept throughout his whole reign. Through his contemporaries and later writers had often re-echoed the imputations, represented him as having only yielded to the solicitations of some amirs and sheikhs. Ibn Kathir also relates in the Chronicles for the year 694 AH that Ghazan embraced Islam during that year. The accounts left by other historians show that the conversion of Ghazan was brought about by a pious Turk, Amir Tuazan by name. Ibn Kathir's version is as follows. In this year, the great-grandson of Genghis Khan, Ghazan, announced his conversion to the faith of Islam, along with all or a majority of the Tartars under him, through the persuasion of Amir Tuazan. Pearls, gold, and silver balls were showered upon those who declared their allegiance to Islam. The king renamed himself as Mahmud and attended Friday prayers. A number of heathen temples and churches were demolished, and poll tax was levied on them. Goods and properties confiscated from Baghdad and other Muslim cities were returned. Justice was restored to them. Rosaries were seen in the hands of the Tartars, for which act of benevolence the people thanked God Almighty. Continuing his account relating to the Islamization of the Mongol Kingdom of Persia, Arnold writes, his brother, who succeeded him in 1304 under the name Muhammad, had been brought up a Christian in the faith of his mother and had been baptized under the name Nicholas, but after his mother's death, while he was still a young man, he became a convert to Islam through the persuasion of his wife. Ibn Butata says that his example exercised a great influence on the Mongols. from the time forward, Islam became a paramount faith in the kingdom of the Ikhans. Coming to the story of the spread of Islam in the Middle Kingdom of the Mongols, Arnold says, "The details that we possess of the progress of Islam in the Middle Kingdoms, which fell to the lot of Shaghthay and his descendants, are still more meager. Several of the princes to this line had Mohammedan ministers in their service, but they showed themselves unsympathetic to the faith of Islam. Shaghthay harassed his Muslim subjects by regulating that restricted their ritual observations in respect to the killing of animals for food and for ceremonial washings. Al-Juzjani says that he was the bitterest enemy of the Muslims among all the Mongol rulers and did not wish anyone to utter the word Muslim before him except for evil purposes. Organa, the wife of his grandson and successor, brought up her son as a Muslim, and under the name Mubarak Shah, he came forward in 1264 as one of the claimants of the disputed succession of Shaghthay, and he was soon driven from the throne by his cousin Burak Khan and appears to have exercised no influence on behalf of his faith. Indeed, judging from their names, they would not appear that any of their children even adopted the religion of their father. Burak Khan is said to have the blessedness of receiving the light of faith a few days before his death and to have taken the name Sultan Ghayaruddin, but he was buried according to the ancient rites of the Mongols and not as a Muslim, and those who had been converted during his reign relapsed into the former religion. It was not until the next century that the conversion of Tarmish Khan Khan in 1326 caused Islam to be generally accepted by the Mongols, who, when they followed the examples of their chiefs, this time remained true to their new faith. But even now, the ascendancy of Islam was not assured, for Buzan, who was a Khan in the next decade, the chronology is uncertain, drove different people from his throne and persecuted the Muslims, and it was not until some years later that we hear that the first Muslim king of Kashgar, which the breakup of the Shaghthay dynasty had erected into a separate kingdom, this prince is said to have owed his conversion to a holy man from Bukhara by name Sheikh Jamaluddin. The Sheikh, in company with a number of travelers, had unwittingly trespassed on the game preservers of the king, who ordered them to be bound hand and foot and brought before him. In reply to his angry question how he had dared to interfere with his hunting, the Sheikh pleaded that they were strangers and quite unaware of trespassing on forbidden lands. Learning that they were Persians, the Sheikh said, "That is a dog worth more than a Persian?" The Sheikh said yes. If he had not true faith, he would indeed be worse than a dog. Struck by his reply, the Khan ordered this bold Persian to be brought before him on his return from hunting, and taking him aside, asked him to explain what he means by these words, faith. The Sheikh then set out before him the doctrine of Islam with such fervor and zeal that the heart of Khan, that before had been as hard as stone, melted like wax, and so terrible a picture did the holy man draw to the state of unbelief that the prince was convinced of the blindness of his own errors, but said, "Where I know to make profession of the faith of Islam, I should not be able to lead my subjects into the true path. But bear with me a little, and when I've entered into the possessions of the kingdom of my forefathers, and it comes to me again, from the empire of Shaghthay had by this time been broken up into a number of different principalities, and it was many years before Taluk-Tumir succeeded into uniting under the entire empire. Meanwhile, Sheikh Jamaluddin had returned to his home, where he fell dangerously ill, and at the point of death, he said to his son Rashiduddin, Tughlaq Timur will one day become a great monarch. Fail not to go to him and salute him in my name, and fearlessly remind him of the promise that he made to me. Some years later, when Tughlaq Timur had re-won the empires of his father, Rashiduddin made his way to the camp of Khan to fulfill the last wishes of his father. But in spite of all of his efforts, he could not gain audience with Khan. At length, he devised the following expedient. One day in early morning, he began to chant the call to prayer close to Khan's tent. Enraged at having his slumber disturbed in this way, the prince ordered him to be brought into his presence, whereupon Rashiduddin delivered the message of his father. Tughlaq Khan was not unmindful of his promise and said, "Ever since I ascended the throne, I have had it on my mind that I made that promise, but that person to whom I gave the promise never came. Now you are welcome." He then repeated the profession of faith and became a Muslim. On that morning, the Sun of Bounty rose out of the east of divine favor and effaced the dark night of unbelief. Certain Turk historians who related the story have related a similar story of the account given above. In this way, Islam won over in a short time its most inveterate enemy, who had trampled underfoot the entire Islamic world and whose onslaught for a time no Muslim power was able to withstand. Islam again proved that it possessed an irresistible charm which can captivate the hearts of the bitterest foes. The Mongols, after accepting the faith of Islam, produced a large number of scholars, doctors of faith, as well as those who fought for the cause of God and served to defend Islam on many critical occasions. Iqbal has rightly said, "A sign manifest did adduce the charge of the Tartar hordes, that defenders are flocked to the Kaaba from the heathen brutes." Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.